You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 4th of October 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live tonight at RadioAryan.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the Greatest Story Never Told, coming in by the back door, and a Freemasonic victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, hello to you, sir. How are you doing?
Good evening, Sven. Yes, I'm fine, thank you. Not been too bad a week, I don't think.
What a crisp, clear sound you have there, Dennis. What could that be, I wonder?
Just by magic, yeah.
You got a new microphone, I hear.
Well, yeah, because it wasn't the lead, it was the actual microphone. What was the problem?
Well, you're certainly sounding so crisp and clear.
A great expense.
Yeah, good man, good man. Hopefully listeners will appreciate that. What have you been up to this week, apart from getting new microphones? Have you been working on the final part of the Freemasonic victory yet?
Yeah, I have, yeah. But it's painstaking for me anyway, because I've got to list all the sources, and like everything else I do, it's never organized. I've never actually, David Irby a log him as he went along, where I just kind of get to the end of the documentary and say, oh, where's them sources gone?
Yeah, it must be quite some work, actually, to then look back and try and find them all.
Especially when your computer's crashed a few times, right?
Yeah, I did the same when I did that Aryan Esoterica series. I wrote everything out. It's the only time I've done a podcast with a script. And then I got to the end of it and I thought, wow, I'm going to have to find sources for all of this. So I had to go right back to the beginning and try and find all the sources. It probably would have been a lot easier to do it as I was going along.
Someone once said,
got to be done.
They said, some guy was criticizing me at one point and he said, really, you should have two sources, which is the normal thing, you know, where you usually get from two different places. But the problem is with that is that they destroyed so much in that 5 years from when they took over Germany. You're lucky to find one source on Freemasonry, especially, you know.
They destroyed so much, didn't they? I mean, not just the books, but artifacts. I was sent a news article today, and I think it was from Argentina. And in somebody's house there, they got a secret passage behind the bookshelves. I mean, it's real Scooby-Doo stuff. And in this secret passage, there's an eagle with a swastika. There's a bust of Adolf Hitler, and there's a load of harmonicas with swastikas on. And, you know, you would think, well, you know, these are artifacts, aren't they? But no, they're totally illegal. I mean, this is horrific. This is terrible. They've taken all these artifacts and they're hiding them in the Holocaust Museum until it can be ascertained whether they are legal or illegal. You know, I mean, just anything to do with the National Socialists, they wanted to destroy after the war so that there was no trace left of them, basically. And anything like that, they'll just say it's illegal today.
Funny you should be talking about that, because there is a market in Germany, but it's obviously so secret and so underground. But I do know somebody who actually deals in the artifacts, but for him to get him into the country, the last time he came into the country, they did check everything off him. He's only just got it back. But the only way that he can get into the country is to say that he's a journalist and he's researching to do an article. Like I said, they took it all off him last time, but he's managed to get it back. So, yeah, there's an underground market, and apparently, you know, it doesn't take long for this guy to shift what he brings back.
Well, you'd think, you know, with it being an unconditional surrender, you would think that the American soldiers, and I mean, we know they did a lot of stealing and theft. You would imagine that there was a lot of stuff that was actually taken that was then sold on. Do you know what I mean? But it seems that even the stuff that was sold on has, you know, it's been taken away again by the governments after that and saying, well, you know, we just don't want any of this. We don't want any evidence that they even existed.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it
was.
Yeah,
well, they do say on websites that, you know, they can't guarantee if you do buy something from a website with the, you know, the swastika, they don't guarantee it actually arriving.
Well, they've banned the sale of any war memorabilia from World War II from eBay, I think, as well.
Really?
Yeah, and lots of places it's banned. I mean, we did have somebody in the chat room who was saying that he could get stuff at his local market, but I think it was probably, you know, copied things or new you know, fake stuff that's been made recently rather than the original stuff. And when you think of all the books that the schools must have had, all the textbooks, you know, I mean,
yeah, they changed all them or destroyed them.
Yeah, they must have destroyed all of them because there's hardly any that you can find. There's like one or two, you know, books on the Hitler Youth. But you imagine all those textbooks they would have had: geography, biology, history, and all told from the National Socialist point of view. And you know, it's all gone. There must be about 1%.
Yeah, and they blame the Nazis for burning books.
Yeah. Well, it's really apocryphal.
Amazon.
Amazon and the biggest book burners. And what was it, the name of their e-book reader? Amazon Kindle? For starting a fire?
I can tell you.
Yeah. It's a rather apt name. Well, we've got, talking of books, we've got the third part in our series on Joseph Goebbels' book, The Nazi Sozi, to get into tonight. I'm really quite enjoying this series, Dennis. I think it's a good pamphlet to get into because it just breaks it down and simplifies things, and you know, we can discuss it and how it applies to today. I mean, you couldn't really do that.
Yeah, it's good.
Couldn't really do that with bits from Mein Kampf, could you? I mean, it's quite technical and, you know, there's a lot of long words, but this Nazi Sozi, it was aimed at the youth, I think, because it's framed that it's like a, I guess, somebody about 35 and he's talking to a teenager about what National Socialism is. So it's seen from that point of view. And also it was, I guess, 15 years before the National Socialists took power. So this gives us an insight into what their first ideas were, and they may have evolved over time. So they may not have been able to carry all of them out.
Well, I read something the other day, actually, about that the Third Reich itself has not ended, because it was all the hierarchy of the army what surrendered. The Third Reich is actually legally still in motion, if you like. It just needed to be organized to be brought back again. I'm saying that it never will be brought back again, but it isn't what people think defunct. The Third Reich is still alive.
Well, that's because they weren't allowed to properly end the war, were they? They had to have this unconditional surrender and then be taken over by the Allies, and then a new system of government imposed upon them, rather than the National Socialists being deposed and somebody else from Germany taking over, or somebody else being voted in. So that, I guess, that they're the legal they're the legal government, aren't they, really? Go on.
Well, people have to remember that Germany wasn't, they didn't have a tyrant forced on them. They actually, you know, democratically voted for Hitler. So it wasn't how it was portrayed, this tyrant that, you know, took over Germany and hypnotized everybody. He was actually democratically voted into power.
Well, they've got a tyrant that's over them now, haven't they? Merkel.
I'm sure they have,
In America. Yep. I mean, that's the dictatorship that was forced upon them, is the system that they have now. Nobody voted for that. That was enforced on them by the winners by the winner of the war. Correct. Well, let's get into this Nazi Sozi then, because this gives us an idea of how National Socialism could have gone if the war hadn't got in the way as well, because there are bits in it that they didn't actually manage to achieve. The next part is production and nationalization. Number one, everything that nature has given the people, the land, the rivers, the mountains, the forests, the natural resources both above and below the ground, the air, all this in principle belongs to the people as a whole. If anyone owns these, he is in effect the trustee of the people's property and must consider himself accountable to the state and to the nation. If he manages the possessions entrusted to him poorly, or in a manner detrimental to the good of the whole, then the state has the right to terminate his ownership and to give his possession back to the people as a whole. So there we get the idea that the water should belong to us, the air should be kept clean, the coal and the natural resources that the country has, the gas, a share of that should be going to the people. And if people are misusing the land, if farmers are misusing the land, then again, that should be taken back. And the people that are working it should just be seen as trustees, which fits
in. Can I just say that is complete opposite to what the United Nations intend to do. The United Nations are intending to own and control all the natural resources, everything, water, land, air, everything.
And then apportion them out. The thing is, once you allow foreigners to buy up bits of your land, which is what's happened, then it gradually gets taken away from the people whose land it is, who have had it for centuries. And that's what happened in Germany. The farms were being bought up by these Jews, which is why they bought the farms back from them and gave them back to the farming families and said, look, this farm has been in your family's hands for centuries and it needs to stay in your hands because we know that you're going to be the one who's going to look after it best. You're not going to build a housing estate on it or hold back the food until it's worth more money, that sort of thing.
A fracking.
Yeah. That sort of thing wouldn't be allowed because it could damage the water table. And alongside these natural resources, you've also got the infrastructure, such as the roads and the railways and the telecommunications, and all of that has been built by the nation. It was, if you look at Britain, for instance, the roadways, they were all built by the Irish navvies, and the railway tracks and the railway stations, they were all built by British people. Mm-hmm. And yet they're in the hands of private companies now that are using them to make as much profit as they can out of the people, when really it was us that built them. We should be the ones that are profiting from them because we built them. It was our labor that built them. It was our land that it was built upon. So why should they be owned by these private companies and a huge profit be made out of us? Obviously, you've got
to... Yeah, it's for corporations, yeah.
Yeah. So this is what they were trying to do away with. But at the other end of the scale, they've got here number two, as far as human strength, talent, inventiveness, enterprise, and ingenuity are concerned, production remains the province of the individual. The state guarantees that every productive person, whether his means of output be muscles or intellect, is given the largest possible share in the goods and profits arising from production. So property was still owned by the individual, and there was still the encouragement to produce the best products that you could, because you would still be getting the reward from private enterprise, basically, which was seen as separate from these vast resources that the country owns and the things that people need to get by, such as heating and water. On the top of that, you've got inventiveness, such as building cars or building motorbikes, and the people that are best at that, you want them to be well rewarded. So it says here they need to be given the largest possible share in the goods and profits that arise from the production. And that's the bit where it differs from communism, which says, well, we'll own everything, we'll own all these big resources, and we'll also take over all the little resources and all the little factories and all the little cottage industries, and that will all be owned by the state. So you really had the best of both worlds in National Socialism, I think.
I agree.
And then we got number three here, production which is essentially complete and thus requires no more further strength, talent, inventiveness, enterprise or ingenuity, such as transportation and communication, trusts, syndicates, etc., is returned to the state, With this, the sequence of production comes full circle and once again incorporates each and every worker responsibly into its cycle. So what it's saying there is that's your telephone network, that's your railways, that has to be owned by the state. That can't be owned privately because it's something that's been created. Yeah. It just requires maintenance, but it doesn't need anything else that's that adding to it. Like your waterways, your sewage systems, your London Underground, all that sort of thing. And really that, you know, that's, what's the best way to describe it? It's an asset. It's an asset that belongs to the nation and it should be, you know, it should give value to the nation. Yeah.
Well, that's when you have a government what cares about the nation, which is not the case with us, where they sold everything off and still do probably.
Yeah, and when you think of a household and you think of how much a household is worth with all the assets that it has, like say you've got cars and boats and machinery or whatever, and that's all owned by the household. Well, all of those things, like the sewage system, the waterways, the electrics, that should be the assets of the nation. That's how much worth that the nation has. Not have it all in private hands. It's like selling off all the silverware, isn't it? Yeah, it's selling off all the silverware. I mean, that's what they used to say, isn't it? The Tories sold off all the silverware, and
Maggie.
Yeah, and I forget what they say about Labour. Neither, you know, both of them are no good. But selling off private industries is, you know, it's just stealing from us because they're just trustees of it.
Yeah, that's right.
But they don't see themselves as that.
It's for the future generations, but Blairs and the Thatchers don't care about future generations.
Well, I think part of it is because they're not, because we have this multicultural system now, instead of looking at everybody and looking at them as being extended family, and you wouldn't want to do that to your extended family, where it's all multicultural. And we're taught we should all be making as much profit as we can for ourselves without regards to the community and everyone that's around us. They think that they're doing, you know, a good thing because they're selling it off. They're making a big profit and that will just come off. Well, I don't even know if it comes off the amount of money that they've borrowed that year because you've got all that interest on it as well. But they probably think, well, I've done well because I've made all this money rather than thinking, well, I've ripped off future generations and they're all going to be paying through the nose for things they should have for free.
Well, that's the problem with capitalism is that when push comes to shove, to get over that profit line, they will sell the grandmother.
Well, there's one good thing actually about the Arab countries and the Muslim countries that they do provide the electric and the water and all of that. They do provide free for their people. They don't charge them.
Which just goes on to show how we're getting ripped off.
Yeah. Well, the normal position would be that you look after your nation, and if they need heat because it's a cold part of the world, then you know you do all you can to provide that heat. I mean, I don't know how they have it in Iceland. I know they've got heating that actually comes from under the ground, but I don't know if they actually charge the Icelandic people for that because there's no way they could live there without that. They have to have that heating. You know, these are essential things that man needs in order to survive. And if it's your ancestors that with their ingenuity and their hard work, they built these systems to keep us alive. I mean, it's disgusting that they would then charge people for it and make a profit from it because it's saying, well, your ancestors were our slaves. They didn't actually own it.
I agree. There's a guy in America, I think he owns like 200 million acres of America. You know what I mean? Like, where it wasn't meant for one person to own all that land. I mean, the Queen owns six of the earth, something like that. When it's in private hands like that, goes against everything that I believe anyway that God actually intended.
Well, there was a time when the idea of actually selling the land was impossible. How could you sell the land? Doesn't belong to you. You know, it belongs to the nation as a whole. You can live on the land, you can build your house on it, and you can say that that's my area, but you couldn't actually sell it. And the system was that when you passed away and you left your land to your descendants, that was why you could only leave it to one of your descendants. What they would do now is they would say, oh, that's unfair, that you have to split it up between everyone. Well, if you split it up between everyone, then nobody gets a whole house and that family house is lost. If it goes to the eldest son, then that land and that house will always be associated with that family, and the other sons that are in the family will have to go out and colonize a new area for themselves. And that was the way it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I get that.
And that encourages growth. It encourages colonizing new areas. And it means that, you know, that family home remains there for centuries. And that was the way that it was. That was the way that it always used to be. And the other side of it, when you're saying there with the queen, and the queen owns all this land, the monarch owned it all. The monarch, you would say, well, the monarch owns all of Britain, and the monarch has the right to apportion out bits of land to people. Say somebody's fought well in a war. Well, the monarch can say, well, you can have this bit of my land here. That's yours. And that's it in perpetuity. And that's how the church got a lot of its properties until Henry VIII stole them back. But that, again, that was the system. So that the monarch actually was responsible for it all, and the monarch could portion it out, but it wasn't really looked at as, you know, the monarch owns that and he could sell it off to foreigners if he wanted.
Personal possession, yeah.
Yeah, because why would the monarch want to do that anyway? Because then he'd be stealing from his own people, or stealing from his own descendants. So, you know, much as in modern day they might attack this system, it was slightly different to the way that we're told. It's like when I said before about the difference between subjects and citizens. They used to say, well, you wouldn't want to be a subject, you're subject to someone that's higher than you. Well, yes, because if you're a subject, you belong to them. You're not an object. They're responsible for you. You're seen as an asset to them. It's like if you know, you're not going to damage your own car because it's your own car. And if you were a subject, you belong to the king, and he would look after you. So all these
long gone are them days.
Yeah, but all these this old way of living, the National Socialists had looked into, and were thinking, well, how can we best transform today so that it conforms with these ideas that we had in the past, because these ideas all conform with natural law, which is what it was all based upon.
Yeah.
He says, by putting this system into effect, we free productivity from the shackles of wage slavery. The result will be a free people with a free economy in a free country, the national community. And that's just what, you know, that's just what we've been talking about. That's why it would become a free country. And also he's mentioning there the shackles of wage slavery. And I guess what he means by that is the only earning enough to exist, which is how most people are today, isn't it? Most of their wages go on paying for the roof above their head, and then they've got to pay for electric, and you've got to pay for heating, you've got to pay for water, you've got to pay for all these things that you need in order to survive.
Poll tax, yeah.
Yeah, and what they were saying is, well, all of those things should come from the wealth that has already been created by us, from this infrastructure that we have, from the electricity grid, from the nuclear power stations that are supposed to just, you know, keep themselves ticking over. Nuclear power isn't supposed to actually cost us anything. It's supposed to be, what's the word for it? Zero sum thing or whatever it is. I can't think of the actual technical term, but that's why they say it's the most greenest power system, or most greenest way of producing electricity is actually nuclear power. Because once you set that cycle off, that's it. It's on its way, and it's producing power for you.
Well, it always amused me when I had to pay 10p for some air, or 20p for some air to put in my tyres.
Yeah, well, they're just trying to charge you for things, aren't they?
Exactly.
Like bedroom tax, window tax, I guess what you got.
It's all indirect tax, isn't it? It's like, I got fined the other week. I went through two speed cameras on the same day, one going and one coming back, and I got fined £200. I don't look at it as a fine, that. I look at it as a tax, because X amount percentage of the nation in that particular year will have been gone through a camera and got caught and got fined. And it's their tax. It doesn't affect everybody, because not everybody's getting fined at the same time. Not like your income tax when you're working. So it's just a direct tax, but it's aimed specifically at, you know, a minimum of people. But eventually we all get caught going through a camera.
Yeah, it's aimed at making a profit for the courts, isn't it? That's the reason for
correct.
It. Because, you know, it's not teaching anyone anything. It's not punishing anyone for doing anything wrong. I mean, somebody was doing a mile faster than they should have been. You know,
36 miles an hour.
Just a mistake.
Yeah, there you go. £500.
There you go. If you're driving dangerously, you know, you're going to harm yourself. But those speed cameras, they're just there to make profits. And also, I think if you look back at the Magna Carta, it says that they're not allowed to give anybody a fine without a court case.
That's been kind of pushed under the carpet type of thing, hasn't it? It's been that isn't what it used to be for us.
Summary justice is what it's called, which we're not supposed to have. If there's a crime that's been committed, you're supposed to be judged by 12 of your peers. You're not supposed to just be told, right, here you go, you have to pay this money over. Because, like you say, that's a tax.
Mm-hmm.
That's not... and also, it's not for committing any real crime. It's for disregarding the guidelines, I guess, or disregarding the rules of the system that we have. And how can it... Go on.
I was just going to... Well, funny enough, when the speed cameras first came out, they were grey and they were hidden. So you didn't actually see them. I mean, these days you get some kind of a warning, although I didn't when I went through mine. But most of these cameras in town, I was going over Hillside. But most cameras in town gather a kind of a warning, and then you can slow down. But when they first came out, they were totally disguised, which is, again, they must have been breaking the law, because they did eventually change it. I don't think they changed these things because they want to.
Yeah, I remember that. And I guess that's because if they disguise them, then they're deliberately trying to entrap you and catch you out. Whereas if they're not disguised, then it's saying, look, we're trying to get you to modify your behavior. So if you see one of these, make sure you're not driving too fast. But what I was going to say there is, you know, with all these statutes that we have and all these rules, nobody could possibly remember them. You know, people are going to break. You know, these statutes that have been sent down by the EU every day. So nobody could remember them all, which is unjust in the first place. But years ago, if there was going to be a new law, somebody had to go around every village in the country, ringing a bell, announcing that there was going to be a new law to make certain that nobody would break it, so that they knew what the law was. And the law was simple. We had a simple law code. Alfred the Great, he collated the former law code that we had when it was just the Britons here, and he added a few Anglo-Saxon bits to it, and that continued right the way through. I mean, I don't know when they started adding to that, probably about the 15th century, but it was just simple law code that everybody knew and everybody could understand, and it was just based on, you know, if you harm somebody, if you steal from them, or if you deceive somebody. And that was it. And that was common law. And then we got the government, the democratic government, rather than the king making our laws. And they come up with all these statutes and things that are illegal.
And they sneak them through as well.
Oh, yeah. Like the doing away with the treason law. Tony Blair sneaked that one through, didn't he? Tacked it on for the back of another law.
Yeah. When people are occupied by someone else, they suddenly slip the odd law or two through.
Yeah, it's very sneaky what they do, and then the courts, the judges are supposed to interpret this law that they've been given, but we just saw just last week how the judges can you know, interpret it how they, however they want, and overrule even the government themselves. I mean, that Supreme Court judgment where they changed the law.
Unanimous.
Yeah, well, that every proroguing of Parliament in the last century is now unlawful, because every single one was done to shut down Parliament and stop them from debating anything so that they could get a new policy across. Every single one of them was. And it was just a normal procedure. Well, it's against
the law for them people to use Parliament to stop Brexit going through. They're not looking at it that way.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Which it is in my eyes.
It's ridiculous. I think what he's going to do is pull the Civil Contingency Act out and say, look, there's going to be civil unrest unless we leave the EU. And because there's going to be civil unrest, we need the Civil Contingencies Act. And the Civil Contingencies Act says we don't have to obey the law. And I think that's what he's going to do. Because he said we're going to.
Quite possible.
Because he keeps saying we're going to obey the law. And that would be doing it.
We're going out on the 31st. Yeah. So
that's the only way that he can do both of them. Well, yeah, let's get back to the Nazi Sozi here and more on the system of governance. Dictatorship, this section is called. It's a long-established fact of history that any young, purposeful party which has deposed a corrupt, internally rotten system has claimed the state and its instruments of power as its own for such a time as it took to establish, by means of a dictatorship guided by self-confident responsibility, the preconditions that were requisite for the complete conquest of the state and its infusion with the new ideas. It will be no different in our case. Once we have captured the state, that state is ours. We, and we alone, will be its responsible representatives. Even if today, in the battle against a corrupt system, we are and must be a party, not of course in the sense of a parliamentary party, the second in which that system collapses, we shall be the state, and then we will remodel that state according to our own principles. And that's something, as he says, this is a long-established principle, because it went on in Rome. When things would become corrupt, there would be a new party would come forward, they would take over, the state, they would have a dictatorship. And then after that, once things had been settled, they would decide on the new form of governance that they wanted to have. Mm-hmm. As it's similar to when a country is at war. And again, at that time, you have a unified state that is running the whole country until the war is over. And then they can have democratic elections and decide on what they want to do.
And vote Churchill out.
Yeah. And that's what they were saying here. They were saying, you know, we need to have a dictatorship to put right the mess that the country is in, but a dictatorship is not the ideal system of governance. It's just a means to an end. They needed to have that. They say, we want to liberate Germany. That's all. A large part of German people have already become so materialistic and cowardly that their good can only be achieved against their will. And I'll just stop there, Dennis, because that's exactly how we are today. When you say to people, we need to stop the invasion, we need to, you know, guard our borders and stop the invaders coming in, they say, oh no, we want open borders, refugees welcome. Even though that's going to cause terrorism and rape gangs and an increase in crime, because our people, like it says here, they've become so materialistic and cowardly, they're deluded, and their good can only be achieved against their will.
That's right.
Yeah, not just immigration, but all sorts. You have to say to people, look, if you want to get men behaving like men again and being honourable, and you want to protect women, then you need to get rid of pornography. You'd have a lot of people saying, oh no, that goes against my individual rights. Pornography.
Well, worse than that today. There's a case in America at the moment where a mother of her son, she's claiming that he wants to be a girl, and she's asking for him to be castrated. And the whole system is backing her.
Yeah, that's horrific. I've done a program on that a while back. Twice, I think we've done programs on that. I think the young lad's name is James and his mother wants to call him Luna. Yeah, we've...
I don't know any more than that. I just know that the system is behind her. And a lawyer was talking and he said something on the lines, that is the moment that I draw the line and that's when I pull the gun.
Well, this is it, Dennis, isn't it? You know, the whole system is on the side of the mother. And that's,
exactly, because that's what they want.
And that's what Goebbels is saying here. And the people are going along with the mother because what they're actually doing is going along with something that's harmful to them. And to try and put a stop to it would actually be against their will because our people have become so deluded and deceived.
Exactly. Yeah.
We are masochists without us even knowing it, that we bring so much of our problems upon ourselves. He says, the party parliament of democracy will be replaced by the economic parliament of the National Socialist State. Its members will be elected by the entire working German people in accordance with the principles of universal suffrage. But in such an election, the people will not stratify themselves according to parliamentary democratic parties, but rather according to the professional guilds making up the national community. Thoroughly organised professional guilds ensure that every working German receives the rights to which he is entitled by virtue of his will, his work, and his responsibility within the state. The economic parliament looks after economic policy only, not politics of the state. So that was the system that they wanted to get to after the dictatorship. They wanted, instead of having political parties, they wanted people to be members of guilds of whatever their career was and in whatever it was that they were best at doing. They wanted people to be part of these guilds. And then you would be electing the very best person at his job, basically. So say
No matter if it's a woman or not.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't matter. Yeah, the very best person for the job. So, you know, if you're in the field of biology, say, and you've got all the best people that work in biology, they're all members of this guild, and they say, well, I vote this person in because they're the very best biologist I can think of. And then that person, the very best biologist, they would then become a member of this economic parliament responsible for biological issues.
And how fast would that advance a country?
Super fast.
I mean, yeah, super fast. I mean, instead of living in a lunatic state, which we are at the moment.
Yeah, and how sensible is that? How sensible is that to just have the people that are the best at doing it? I can remember years back, before I was a nationalist, and the Labour Party, I think it wasn't the Home Office, it was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And they put this guy, who was originally a postman, as the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And I can remember thinking, what is this? Is that what they do? What does he know about economics? He was a postman. Why is he being put in charge of that? And that was really, you know, one of the first times that I thought something very strange is going on here because they're doing deliberately stupid things. It shows you that they're not putting in the people that are the best at their job. They're basically that those positions that they've got, anybody can do them. And you know, you can't have anybody running pulling the levers of state. You want the very best people.
Yeah, that's only, like I say, if you care about your country. But as far as I were concerned, in 1933, when Roosevelt gave the speech, and he brings out his pyramid on the back of the dollar, he's actually saying that the government is now totally infiltrated and will work to bring itself down, which in other words means that the traitors have taken over. And that's continued ever since.
Well, they're working against the good of the people, aren't they?
Correct.
And this fits in with the New World Order, looking at everybody as just an economic quantity, and saying that anybody can do anybody else's job, and everything needs to be made so that anybody can do anyone else's job, so that they can just pick anyone from Africa and stick them in a job in the NHS. And they've got a list of things that they have to do. I mean, this is why you've got so much paperwork and bureaucracy and tick boxes. And all the African's got to do is make sure that he does each one of these things on this list. And then that's it. That's it. That's his job done. And that's the same going right the way up to government. Yeah.
If you want to make everybody equal, you can't raise it. You've got to bring it down.
Well, that's just it, doesn't it? It does bring everything down. And there's no room for excellence. And there's no room for...
The word doesn't exist.
There's no room for proper professionalism. It's like when you look at doctors. I mean, if you look at doctors now, it's all tick boxes and flow charts. And before, a doctor would be looking at you, and from the moment he shook your hand, he would be thinking about the strength of the handshake, the speed of the heart, the look on the face, the color of the skin, the smell, and they would be working everything out holistically as to what the problem could be. And it might well be that it's something that he recognizes before from the past, but that doesn't actually fit all the symptoms for one particular condition or whatever. And that doctor would be able to say, well, I think you've got this condition, even though the textbooks will say that you haven't, but because I think you might have this condition because I've seen it in someone in the past, I'm going to give you this medication. And that would have been perfectly fine. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that person would have been given medication. Yeah. Now they couldn't chance doing it. They couldn't chance doing it because it's all flow charts and tick boxes.
Here's a pill.
And no room for leeway, no room for the expertise that comes from being an expert in your class for decades.
Wonderful.
But of course, there was always an alternative elite out there, the usury elite, the shadowy elite, and they're running the things like the civil service. And that's how come these politicians can just be parachuted into all these different positions, because the civil service is there, which will tell them how to behave and what to do and all the rest of it. And the civil service are always there, even though these politicians get voted in and voted out. And they're part of the deep state. And that's where a lot of the corruption comes from, I think. That's this leftist lean that they have. Comes from the civil service, and they're not accountable to anyone.
That's right. Well, they voted in.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They're not accountable, not voted in. And it was because of them that, or largely due to them, that Theresa May decided to just ignore the people that were negotiating Brexit and do her own thing. That was on her own advisors. And also when she called that early election, that was on the advice of her advisors. And she lost the election, or it ended up with almost a hung parliament. She lost the majority.
Yeah, she lost a lot of things.
Because she had no idea of what she was doing on her own. She was just used to listening to what other people tell her to do. She wasn't a leader. She couldn't lead the country. I do think Boris is a leader type, but Theresa May never was.
Boris is quite likable. I mean, let's not forget about Bush. He is one of the elites, and he used to go with Cameron to Eton and places like that. But he is quite likable to, I would say, the voting public. He does say things which, you know, they like to hear.
Yeah, he's positioning himself as if he's on the side of the people, and he's actually having some success in doing that. Theresa May, I don't think she even tried to do that, and she would have just been seen as completely insincere if she did. Yeah, we'll have to watch.
Well, her husband actually had his job was to find tax cuts for the extremely rich. So he knew all the loopholes in the tax system, and he would sort of all this tax evasion out. So, you know, when they're going to bed at night, I don't think they're discussing the common man.
What was Theresa May? What was her expertise? What was she best at doing?
Well, I think she was given the police thing, weren't she?
She was the Home Secretary. But what was she? What was she an expert at doing? This, I mean, if you compare that to this system that the National Socialists wanted, you know, the economic parliament.
What experience did she have?
Yeah, the economic parliament that looks after economic policy, and it's made up of the absolute very best people in every one of the fields that is associated with the economy. So you would have had experts in there running the economic parliament. So that's why I say, what was Theresa May an expert at? Nobody even knows.
I don't think she was an expert. Like I said, you know, how fast does a country accelerate when you've got your best people doing the best work in the right positions? It's got to accelerate things.
You know, we just look at how far advanced the National Socialists were. But another point to this, I mean, when they're talking about these guilds, that goes back to the Middle Ages. And we did have these guilds in the Middle Ages. And also, when you had a monarch, the monarch was brought up to know that he was going to rule. And so were the princes and so were the royal family. So they were given training in running a country, running a government, how to govern people from a young age. So they actually had training in what they were going to be doing once they were an adult, and they had the expertise of their family to call upon. But you can't have that now because the royal families are all corrupted. So then the next best thing would be this system here, where you just ended up with the best man for the job getting the job, and the voting bit would just come from within that guild. So only the people who are really qualified to vote would be voting. Do you know what I mean? Biologists again.
You do have the Rhodes Scholar, though, don't you? That, I suppose, is their expertise when they send them out all over the world to run governments.
Yeah, you got
that. They are specifically taught, aren't they?
Yeah, we have that. And you know, that's not that bad a system when you think about it, because it's getting the brightest people and ensuring that they get a good education. It's just that they're not being educated in the right things.
New World Order, yeah.
But the idea of a scholarship is, you know, that's great, really, yeah, the idea of a scholarship. And again, that was a National Socialist thing, was that the brightest people need to be given the best education. Those that aren't so bright, you know, they can be taught something else. They don't need to be learning science and technology. You know, they could be learning.
What we said
learning
before, haven't we? Yeah, it's just a waste of time, isn't it? Just when you've got these schools where children who are actually talented in certain areas are stuck in classes which they've got no interest in.
And they could be out learning bricklaying or carpentry or
whatever the talent,
of trades. What, you know, whatever they enjoy doing and whatever they're good at doing. Because if you're good at doing something, you're going to enjoy doing it.
Correct.
And vice versa. Yeah, and vice versa. You don't want to be doing something you don't enjoy doing. So that was the Economic Parliament, and its partner in government is the Senate. And that is composed of some 200 individuals who the dictator selects from all ranks and professional guilds and who assist in the affairs of the state. These 200 will represent the elite of the entire nation. They support the government with both advice and action and are appointed for life. In the case of a member's death, the others elect a replacement. So there's no career thing here. You've got that job for life. Yeah. So I'm just trying to think of the positives and the negatives. With that, obviously the positives are that the dictator is going to be the best man of the lot, and he's going to pick people that he thinks have got a good character, that put the nation's needs above their own needs. And I guess,
well, it's funny, the dictator has a bad press with most people because of the propaganda. When you look at, you know, Gaddafi and one or two others, you know, they were dictators what did for the country more than any government has done for us in Britain.
Oh, loads more. I mean, a dictator can actually get things done. I was just thinking, if people have got a job for life, then, you know, they're not going to be trying to step on top of somebody else in order to get higher up the chain.
Yeah.
There's going to be less potential for corruption, I guess. I mean, it's sort of like the House of Lords, isn't it? It's like a House of Lords that he is suggesting here. But that are picked just by the leader. There isn't any democratic bit in it. They're picked by people that don't know what they're doing, but they're picked directly by the man right at the very top, and they answer to him.
I always remember there was a case in America when Bush was president where a guy had kidnapped two girls. He'd been arrested, but they didn't know where the girls were, and the guy wouldn't tell them. And eventually what happened was the girls were tied up in some kind of place in, out in the woods somewhere, and they died of starvation. Whereas if that would have happened in a country with a dictator, the guy would have probably been telling them where they were after a couple of minutes, because they wouldn't wait for a court knowing that these girls had starved.
Well, the dictator can always override the rules, can't he? I mean Hitler overrode the rules quite a few times. And I'm just thinking of people that it was discovered that they had partial Jewish heritage, but they'd shown that they were good people and they put the nation above all else. And so Hitler could override the Nuremberg laws and they could keep their job and they could keep doing what they do, because there are always exceptions to the rules. That's another natural law. There is always going to be an exception to the rule. So you have to have somebody that can override the rules to compensate for that.
Well, it would have saved them two girls, I'm sure. I mean, once one fingernail had been pulled, I don't think it would have been long for him to talk.
Yeah, well, that's getting into torture. And I guess there is a legitimate use for that in some instances, like the one that you are just suggesting there, Dennis. But there is also the case of Hannah Reich. I mean, the National Socialists were keen for women to, you know, to enjoy doing what they do best, being mothers and homemakers and housekeepers and looking after their men folk and their children. But at the same time, you do get exceptions to the rule, and you do get women that are very good, exceptionally good at doing some things that normally are within the man's world. And they made exceptions for them. You know, Hannah Reich is an example of that.
I read something the other day that the Germans didn't allow women to wear makeup.
The only reason I could see them suggesting that is if it was harmful, as if it had lead in it or, you know, harmful heavy metals in it.
I'm pretty sure I've seen some German women with makeup on, though.
Yeah, well, definitely. It's ridiculous. But they did come up with the Clean Air Act, and they wanted to get rid of the pollution, and they were very, very much into health, so they didn't want unhealthy foods. And, you know, if there was some types of cosmetics that had dangerous stuff in them, then I could see them banning them. Or that had been tested on animals. I mean, they used to put radioactive substances. You know, just 100 years ago, people would ingest radioactive substances. I mean, that's no good for you, like barium or radium.
Not recommended, no.
You know, they would give you mercury for syphilis and things like that. Yeah, so, you know, the National Socialists didn't want the nation to become ill. And I mean, we've talked before about how you weren't able to do anything that was harmful to the nation. And that was the
basic overriding thing. You'd never find 1,400 girls raped in Berlin somewhere.
Well, you wouldn't find people profiting from doing anything that was harmful. You wouldn't have had, you know, an abortion industry or a pornography industry. Probably wouldn't have had a gambling industry. I don't know quite how they were with gambling. I haven't read them talk much about that. Do you know if they spoke much about gambling, Dennis?
Do you know, that's something that I couldn't really speak on, like, but I presume there must have been some kind of gambling, but then again,
I doubt very much whether they would have allowed the state of things that we have today, where people can just go in a betting shop and lose all their money.
Must be awful if you're addicted. That must be a real problem.
Yeah, with those machines that can just empty you out of everything and pay you back loads. I mean, none of that would be allowed because of the harm that it causes.
Yeah, definitely.
What does it say here? The next bit. The Chancellor will be elected from among the Senate. He bears full responsibility for every aspect of the Reich's domestic and foreign politics and is prepared to sacrifice even his own life, if necessary, for the sake of these political affairs. The Chancellor chooses his own ministers and staff. He takes full responsibility for their actions as well. And it therefore goes without saying that he can appoint and dismiss them at will. So he has total power there, the Chancellor. And again, and you know, you think this was written 15 years before the National Socialists took power, and Hitler did sacrifice his own life. And he did bear responsibility for every aspect of the Reich's domestic and foreign politics. He took responsibility for all of that, and he did sacrifice his own life at the end for the sake of their political affairs. So you can't
have something right at the start to say that the whole government would lay down their life to get these policies through to help the country, something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was the promise that they made, was, you know, they weren't promising, all what they were promising them is a very, very hard life, and they may end up actually having to give up their life for the goals that they're trying to achieve for the nation. You know, and we said that was like the Christian verse, there's no greater love does a man have than he lay down his life for his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And pointing out the similarity to that. So this was basically the system that was going to be put in place after the dictatorship. Well, it was still similar to a dictatorship. You've still got a guy at the top that runs everything, but you've got a system for how he can be replaced, which you don't have with like the dictator in Zimbabwe or in North Korea, say. So you've got what you've got here is I do think it bears a lot of similarity to the monarchy and the absolute power of the monarch, but it's an improved version of it where people get that power through merit rather than through being the son of the previous king.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
Because it is very similar. And he says, whether the head of this system of government is a president or a monarch will then be irrelevant. The Chancellor is the one who matters, and you can be sure that we will see to it that he is a man of courage and integrity. So that's just showing you that it is similar to a monarchy, but the question of whether they should have a monarchy or whether they should have a republic, that's really irrelevant. What they need is the best system of government that they can come up with. And this idea that they have, I mean, that takes the best of both worlds, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's why they got rid of it as fast as they could.
And that was how it was supposed to advance to as well. So the system that they had with Adolf Hitler as the Führer and the National Socialism that they had, that wasn't supposed to be like that for all time. Hitler wasn't supposed to be there forever. They were going to put this system in place so that Germany would be guaranteed from then on the very best people in the best positions, in the most important positions, people that were responsible for their actions and that could be blamed for their actions or praised for their actions, and in actual fact would step forward and fall on their own sword if they had failed.
That's right.
And again, that was the example that was set by Adolf Hitler. Well, we're going to have to do a part four on this series, Dennis.
Yeah.
We've still got three sections to go. We've got war and pacifism, Lebensraum, and Germany's freedom. I don't know if it will take up a whole episode, but yeah, we'll have to look into that one next week, I think, because we're just about out of time here now. So thank you very much for coming on.
Once again, pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Will Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.